something in the tray.
From each separate county. So that's what they'll do in the next committee. They'll actually solicit each individual county.
We're on the tape.
Happen to hip all of that.
The Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. I'm reading from When Janie Comes Marching Home, Their Portraits of Women Combat Veterans. This is written by Master Sergeant Bonnie McCusick, U.S. Air Force. I ended up getting divorced when I got back, and some things had happened while I was over there that made it really hard. I came home to an empty house, so that was the adjustment part. We were married for 7.5 years. He was in the Marine Corps, always deployed, and I was deploying military to military. Military to military is hard in itself, but then when you have two members deploying all the time, when you're apart more than you're together, that's the adjustment that I'm talking about. Separation is hard for people, and I'm not throwing any blame. You just have to move on, and the next day is going to be a better day, and hope for that, and so that's what I had to do. But I would go back and do it again in a heartbeat. They think I'm crazy. My own leadership says, you want to do that again? What's wrong with you? And I just loved it. I love the experience. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Thank you very much. Colleagues, members of the public, we're actually going to go straight down the agenda today. However, I do want to note that previously posted up on OLIS before, we had Senate Bill 94 scheduled. It is actually has a sister bill, House Bill 2633, in the House, and the House is going to take up 2633. So if you had input or comments either in the audience or out in the good public on Senate Bill 94, that mechanism is now House Bill 2633 on the far side. With that, Madam Counsel, we're going to open a public hearing on SB 85. If you bring us up to speed, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 85 permits local governments to provide financial assistance to qualifying real property owners for seismic preparedness improvement. It describes the type of assistance and the parameters of financial arrangements, conditions financial agreements on written notice and consent of any affected mortgagees as specified, and declares an emergency is effective on passage and has no subsequent referral.
Thank you, Council. Elizabeth Edwards and Shelley Hack, if you're in here. And, well, Council, is this one of the bills that came from House Veterans, or is this one of the resilience bills?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this was introduced by Representative Boone during the interim. It's one of Representative Boone's bills.
Ladies first.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Edwards, and I'm with the City of Portland. Also with me is Shelley Hack with the Portland Development Commission. I'm going to do sort of a quick high-level overview, and then I'll turn it over to Shelley for a few more details. This committee is well aware of what can and will happen when the Cascadia subduction zone ruptures. We know that it's not a matter of if, but when, and we know that we're unprepared. Much of the time, money, and effort has been focused so far on public buildings and public infrastructure, and this bill is just one small step to address the tremendous public health and safety issue that will arise from private buildings. A classic example comes to us from unreinforced masonry buildings. These units were never intended to withstand seismic shaking. The code simply didn't require it of them at the time they were built. But earthquakes around the world have taught us that these buildings are some of the most vulnerable to collapse during heavy shaking. Mortar is not strong enough to hold the brick, and those bricks can peel off from the exterior of the building. This poses an immediate life safety threat to both occupants and especially passersby. They also pose a long-term economic impact to communities and to the recovery of those communities, because when these buildings fail, they cause damage to neighboring properties, they displace, often permanently, businesses and residents, and they generate debris that blocks the right-of-way and disrupts transportation routes, which is especially critical during times of emergency. And these buildings are often prohibitively expensive to retrofit, which is why we're looking at this bill. Portland has a very high concentration of unreinforced masonry buildings. We have over 1,000, well over 1,000 in our city. So that's why we're here, seeking authority from the legislature to be able to make loans and work with private lenders to help finance seismic rehabilitation of commercial and industrial buildings, as well as multifamily residential dwelling units, because we consider it to be a major public health and safety issue. And one more thing that I'll highlight before I turn it over to Shelley is that it's important to remember that this program, if it came into being, would be voluntary for local governments to use the tool. It would be voluntary for private building owners to participate. And if there was a mortgage on the property, then the mortgagee would have to be provided with written consent before an owner could enter into a financing agreement. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll turn it over.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist. My name is Shelley Hack, and I am a business opportunity officer with the Portland Development Commission. I'm here today in support of the bill and to encourage your approval. This bill grew out of a process the City of Portland is engaged in to reevaluate its existing seismic retrofit codes. These buildings, unreinforced masonry buildings in particular, are the most vulnerable in our building stock. But yet, at the same time, they define the character and the culture of many of our neighborhoods. As Ms. Edwards said, there are over 1,000. Actually, the number is more like about 1,250 known seismic or unreinforced masonry buildings, in the Portland area. And so as we've embarked along this process, we've identified some guiding principles for how we want to evaluate our code. One is to protect life and safety. Another is to support the City of Portland's disaster and economic resiliency, and to provide public and private investment in the city's infrastructure, to preserve the historic nature of the unreinforced masonry buildings, and then also to lessen the financial burden and incent quick execution on the part of building owners. And our goal is to reduce the public safety, but to do this in a way that's financially sensitive to the existing building owners, both public and private. And this bill would provide local jurisdictions with a new tool to help finance seismic retrofits and of privately owned buildings. As Ms. Edwards said, this program would be a tool, not the tool, but it would expand the tools that we have in the toolkit. So with that, I'll turn it over.
To Representative Boone.
Good afternoon, committee chairs and members. This is Deborah Boone coming to you from House District 32. And I was really just the Sherpa on this bill. Elizabeth brought it forward to me, and we've been finding this in this resilience planning that different entities, as they hear about it, they want to join the party, so to speak. And we were just over in the other committee passing some bills through, too. So we had engineers in our room and architects. You might have some in the back here. But I give all the credit to Elizabeth for everything that she's done, and you, too. Sorry. This is part of our resilience plan work, and it's up to you, Senator Courtney, to make sure it all gets funded. Thank you.
And Vice Chair, question?
It's just loans for, it says, multifamily residential dwellings or commercial or industrial buildings, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Olson, question?
Yes, I do.
Please.
I was on that resilience task force. This is good legislation, but are there any caps on these loans as to the amount that they can borrow?
Senator Buckwith, Senator Olson, the way this bill is written, there aren't caps currently included. Shall I defer?
The caps would be based upon an underwriting of the transaction, and as written, the legislation would allow local jurisdictions to create the programs, and in their creation, the jurisdiction would have to figure out and determine what guidelines they wanted to impose on the program. But there would need to be a financial analysis of the project.
Follow up, please. One of the other sidebars I would recommend you look at is the fact that as a builder, I understand the ramifications and what you can and can't do, that we're not able to, under the guise of retrofitting for seismic, that we actually remodel the building. and add space or remodel insides and use these funds to do that. I'd be very cautious of that because that could happen.
Right.
And I would suggest that, you know, your sidebars and what you lay out, it clearly indicates that this is for retrofitting only, and any work beyond retrofitting is, you know, at the cost and not the proceeds not out of this loan. But I also look at the amount because retrofitting older buildings can be extremely expensive. So just, you know, word of caution. It's a good plan, good bill, just a word of caution.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Courtney, any questions? Okay, I have four. First one, I'm just for the record, you know, I've read through the bill. It appears to me to be a permissive authority, and the sponsors and the promoters here don't perceive there's any state liability.
Senator Courtney, that's correct.
I asked
about Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Can you briefly describe the public-private partnership? And the only thing that jumps out is clarification. Does it create the traditional private, which falls under Davis-Bacon, or how do you perceive this going forward?
Well, the legislation would authorize both public financing as well as private financing to use this ultimate structure. Mm-hmm. So although I am not a legal counsel and we would need to consult legal counsel, as we've been looking at this structure for an energy retrofit program that the was passed last year, it's our expectation at this point that if it's privately financed with a private lender, that it would not be subject to Davis-Bacon and those rules. If it was a bond were floated by a public body to finance the improvements, then yes, it would likely be subject to Davis-Bacon.
And I'm only trying to bring this out on the record so we don't have to come and visit this next time around. The last thing, and could you just expand slightly on your last topic, because that was my last question for the record. There is some perception that, you know, one of the tools local government might have is local bonding, which they could then use for this program. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Next panel is Walt McMoney's and Gwen Baldwin.
Sorry, I wrote her name. Ran out of space.
That's okay. You're still welcome. And unless there's a legal precedence, ladies can go first.
Yeah. This is going to be the shortest testimony. I'm basically his support system. Gwen Baldwin, I'm here representing what we finally refer to as the Brickers, the Masonry Building Owners of Oregon. We represent folks who have properties predominantly in the I-5 corridor and whose properties are largely unreinforced and partially unreinforced. So we are very excited about this opportunity. So with that, I will lateral to Walt McMoney's.
Hi, I submitted some written testimony. So you guys may have read that. I'm Walt McMoney's. My business address is 601 Southwest 2nd Avenue in Portland. We did form an organization called, I call it MBU. She calls it Heritage Brickers. But it's basically 25 families that own about 125 unreinforced masonry buildings, mostly apartment buildings, but there are definitely some commercial ones as well. And most of us are good guys who want to upgrade our buildings, but the problem is it's very expensive. I've actually done about a 50-60% upgrade on one of my buildings, and it's cost $500,000 to do that. It's a 46,000 square foot building, so I'm actually coming in pretty cheaply. I've only spent about $20 a square foot so far, but I'll probably have to spend $40 to $45 a square foot by the time I'm through. It's a very expensive thing. We want to do it. We need to do it. We believe that the subduction earthquake is coming. The problem that we're in is it just costs more money than even reasonably well-off property owners can handle. And the problem is you can't get a second construction loan very easily, because once you have a first mortgage on a property, which most people do have, the first mortgage holder generally doesn't have any interest in letting you have a second on the mortgage on the property. So you're in this situation where you want to raise, let's say, $500,000 to do your seismic upgrade. The first lender won't let you do that because they're afraid that the property is going to be over leveraged, too much debt. And that really, and one of the other problems is that a seismic upgrade does not have a very efficient payback. I use the term payback. It's sort of like return on investment. If you spend $800,000 on a building to seismically upgrade it, you might get $40 a month rent, more rent. That'll pay you back with some savings in earthquake insurance and some other things in about 20 years. That's not the sort of thing people, that's not a great return on investment. Compare that with putting like washer dryers in your building at a cost of $80,000. You get the same $40 more a month, which pays you back in 5 years. That's the kind of investment people say, gee, I'll do that. The 20-year payback just isn't there. These unreinforced masonry buildings are really, they're you know, I love them, and I own five or six of them. But and the other people in our group who own these buildings love them as well. But they weren't designed. The three little pigs were right. They're great against fire, wind, and so on. But the three little pigs didn't have to deal with earthquake. Had they been dealing with earthquake, the wolf would have gotten them. So. They do have this deficiency, but they're worth saving. And when you think what the replacement cost is, the replacement cost is maybe $160 to $200 a square foot. The retrofit cost is maybe $40 to $50 a square foot. And again, even with the very generous second loans from local jurisdictions, that's only going to be like a quarter of what has to be spent to do this. So there's going to be money coming from various sources, including significantly the pockets of the people who are owning these buildings. That's about all I need to hit on, I think. Any questions?
Madam Vice Chair. Senator Olson?
Yes.
Please.
You hit on a really good point, that second mortgage that banks are concerned about. Do you think that this bill will allow you the flexibility to get around that, because you have to go to the mortgage holder and say, hey, by the way, I'm going to borrow another $500,000 on this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The underwriting is going to have to be carefully demonstrated to the lender, the first lender. You're going to have to say the debt coverage is still there, that is, that there's enough income to pay the debt. The loan to value is still there, and you're only at 75% of value. You're not at 110% of value, so you're going to have to demonstrate to meet their underwriting requirements. The other thing is, I wish there were a little bit more of a kick in the pants to the first mortgage, because some of them are fairly unreasonable. I have a building, Fannie Mae DUS has an apartment loan on it. They had no interest in letting me get a second to do seismic upgrading. And I really didn't have any ability to. It was, you know, it's owned by a Wall Street. I mean, Fannie Mae DUS are like conduit loans. They're sold to the market as in bundles. So some people at Wall Street own this loan. They just want to see their 10 years of, you know, 7% income coming back. They don't want to mess with me, with my seismic upgrade. So I wish there were a little mechanism to force them to be a little bit more considerate of these things. But I guess the selling point here is you are going to probably have mandated upgrading. So these buildings are going to be sort of under threat of red tagging, which the Wall Street guys aren't going to like. So they're going to say, okay, if the building's going to get red tagged and can't even be occupied, then we will definitely have to go along with you and let you do this seismic upgrading. But there has to be a stick there, unfortunately, which the building owners don't want to have, but I think that it's coming. At least in Portland, we're going to have mandatory seismic upgrading.
Follow up, please. And your buildings, predominantly what you and your group own, are they pre-60s buildings or are they pre-80 buildings?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think they really stopped building totally unreinforced masonry buildings in about 1933 or 34. So most of these buildings date from the late 1800s till about 1930, 1933. My buildings, I've got a 1910 building, a 1909 building, a 1926 building, 1933 building. Those would be a typical distribution of buildings.
A follow-up, please. How did they react to the Malala earthquake of 96?
I have the remember the ad for Maytag washing machines where the guy never got a call, and he's so excited when he finally gets a call. Well, FEMA had set up out here after the Molalla earthquake, and my building called the Trinity Place had one of its bays come unsecured and come out about 3 inches. So I called up the FEMA guy and I said, "Hi, I've got a claim. Do you guys have some low interest money or something you can help me fix this building?" And he's so excited. I was the only person who'd called. He came over in like a half hour, and he gave me like $15,000 in form of a loan to do that. But unfortunately, fixing the building after the mega earthquake is going to be, you're going to have a pile of bricks.
Right.
So hopefully we can do it on the front end before the earthquake happens, and then we won't have the same problem.
Thank you. Recording?
Nope.
Just a couple of quick clarification questions. You heard earlier I mentioned, if you have a public-private partnership, there are certain categories that might fall under Davis Bacon. You are aware of that?
Yeah, I've learned something today. I know that when it's a government project, it's Davis Bacon, and I am actually an attorney, but I don't practice in the construction area. So, yeah, I mean, I think we would want to probably avoid Davis Bacon. It's pretty expensive, but if we can't, then we, we pay the Davis Bacon. I've done one project which was had Davis Bacon, and it was fine.
I'm only raising that so that because we have multiple bills in this building right now. We're going back and correcting public-private partnerships to make sure that those that did apply and didn't apply. And then I was just to clarify, you're actually Masonry Builders Association. I noticed that the letter online says Lane Powell, but that's just the registered.
That's my law firm.
Okay.
They're nice enough to let me sit there in my office and work on seismic issues and not bill any time. So I give them the credit of putting my misses on their letterhead.
Okay, careful. Someone's not on revenue. We might want to come collect off that one. So I don't have any other questions. I do appreciate that. We do have two other people to testify, though.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Susan Stewart and Nikki is out there. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on this bill? I only see one person moving.
Chair Boquist, Susan Stewart sends her apologies. She couldn't make it down today due to an emergency.
Okay.
But I am here, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Nikki Terzieff, on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association, BOMA. We are in support of this bill. We're acutely aware of both the dangers and the expenses of not having seismic retrofits and having buildings that are not safe for occupancy should the worst occur. And so we're encouraging, I'll just be brief, we're encouraging you all to support this bill.
Questions? Okay. Anybody else that wants to testify on this? Any comments from committee members? The only thing I see for the record is that I would ask that there were a half dozen people who testified, and we did raise the eyebrow of bonding and Davis-Bacon and public-private partnerships. It is permissive, is the way the bill is written. I should suggest you compare notes, because unless I hear anything else, we'll schedule this for a work session next week. If there is anybody else that does want to testify next week, we will open the work session up so that they can testify. Any other comments? With that, we will close the public hearing on SB 85. We're going to open a temporary work session on SB 53. Council, if you would please just refresh our memory.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 53 was the extension of the sunset on the tax credit for the provision of services under TRICARE contracts. This was previously heard on the 10th of February. It has a subsequent referral to joint tax credits. Came back with a revenue light, of course, due to the subsequent referral for further analysis later if the committee were inclined to move it, and there was no fiscal. This is the one where, as a function of statutory interpretation, no certifications for providers to claim this credit have issued from the Office of Rural Health after 2011. So it's sort of expired on its own, plus it has the sunset, which is 2016.
Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify on this bill? Colleagues, if you'll recall correctly, Chris came up here and testified before. This has already expired 2 years ago. There's no indication that it's being utilized, and we haven't heard a single word that it is needed. Unless somebody else has something else to say, it's my intent of the chair not to move the bill, and we'll draft a letter to send to the Joint Tax Committee where this has got to go, telling them we just didn't have any input and there's no evidence that we need it at this point. I will send that around to all three of you. You'll have 48 hours to comment because we have a three-day window, and if I don't get any comments back, then that's what we'll go through, unless somebody has something else. If not, seeing nothing, then we'll close the work session on SB 53, open a work session on SB 54, if you would please, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 54 was the extension of the sunset on the tax credit for care of Oregon's veterans' home residents. This was also previously heard on February 10th. Came back with a revenue light due to subsequent referral to joint tax credit.
Is there anybody in the audience that was not here before that would like to testify on SB 54? Members, Chris is here to answer any questions. You'll recall this was a tax credit that was used. This, Chris, could you refresh my memory, the amount of this one? This is very small, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The historical cost of it
And while he's digging, colleagues, this would be the same thing. We have to send an accompanying letter. If we did pass it out, we'll send the draft out to all four members so that you can review it. We'd have to have it back in 20, or comments back within 48 hours so that we can then make the recommendation that is required to go with the bill if we move it forward. And
the annual cost has been about $15,000. It is a credit. The structure of the credit, just to refresh the committee's memory, is $1,000 per every eight individuals that the doctors see, up to $5,000. Part of the testimony last time was that I believe there are only three physicians who are visiting the veterans home right now, so that would be at $15,000, that would be the maximum for the three physicians if they saw as many as they could.
Any questions of legislative revenue? Your pleasure, Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bogos, I move Senate Bill 54 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference.
Excuse me, Madam Vice Chair. Mona Sanderson moves SB 54 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Can you please call? Actually, I think we have to call the roll on this one. Or can we do it without opposition?
You can do it without opposition.
Is there any opposition to this bill? Then so ordered. Again, colleagues, we're going to send out the text of this one so everyone can review it over the next 48 hours, and then it will be sent downstairs or down to the hall or, I don't know where, across the way to joint blesses. It's coming back to me. I know that. With that, we're going to close the work session, SB 54, open a work session, SB 432. This is the 911 enhancement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 432 has a no revenue and an indeterminate fiscal with a recommendation from the Legislative Fiscal Office to request or recommend adding a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. It was previously heard on February 24th, and this is the same result as happened to it the last time when it came through in 2013. This is the measure that reiterates that funds that are held in the emergency communications account must be used for purposes described at ORS 403-240. It requires statutory change in fiscal emergency to deviate from the purposes described there. Declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Comments, any committee members? Madam Vice Chair, your pleasure.
Just refresh my memory. So this means the monies can't be swept.
Check. Of course, that means the monies can't be checked until we, the legislature, change the law again. And just to be technically clear, every time we've swept the monies before, we have changed the law. But there is some restrictions on there, I do believe. Senator Olson, you want to clarify?
Mr. Chair, to clarify, the money can be swept if the governor declares a fiscal emergency. And then we can get the money, which makes it, you know, up to the governor that says we need it, which I assume then we would take it. Until that point, we can keep it in the account so that we can get those needed technical upgrades.
You want to take on another week, madam?
Well, you know, this is a policy committee, and and Ways and Means, it sure would be nice to have, if they want, either of the co-chairs or both the co-chairs talk to us about the need to be able to sweep funds. You know, I'm not involved with prioritizing, et cetera, and those Ways and Means people really do No, and I don't think they'd want to sweep funds unless it was absolutely imperative to the safety, to, you know, they're the ones that do the prioritization, and we want to make sure that we can always meet current service levels, and sometimes we haven't been able to, and though I would hate to hurt our public safety system, hate to hurt our educational system, and hate to hurt our most vulnerable in the healthcare system. So we didn't have anyone actually testify from Ways and Means, and I certainly should have, but didn't have a conversation with either of our co-chairs.
And just for the record, to remind everyone, this is going down to, this is being referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for them to make that determination. But Senator Olson, please.
I wholeheartedly applaud the good senator's concerns over money being swept, but the thing that concerns me the most is when we sweep this money, we can't get that technology we need to keep the system current so that we can find those people that are in need, such as low income, who sometimes don't know exactly where they live, or maybe the homeless don't know where they live but have the opportunity to make a call. These new technologies that we can purchase with this money, if it's still available to us, benefits all of us greatly. If it is swept, once again, we have to build that piggy bank up to get those new technologies. And as you well know, we both have sat here with different types of computers every year. Technology changes quite frequently, and to have the 911 system have the ability to use those funds to make those technical changes is extremely important. And it, you know, it is a matter of safety. It is a matter of financing the ability to meet the current safety needs. And since it is going down to Ways and Means, we can make the argument down there. Maybe they'll take a look at it. This is one of the funds that I think that I don't think there's anything important enough that we would have to take this money at any time, because it does wholeheartedly go to the heart of our system of safety for people, and it is that link of communication. And I guess we'll debate that down in Ways and Means.
Senator Courtney, any comments?
You say the governor can override this?
Yes.
Where does it say that?
It says it in the bill. Monies on page one, monies in the emergency communications account, including the enhanced 911 sub account, may be used only as described in section 102 of section of this, unless this section are modified to allow different use or eliminated by amendment or appeal. As used in this section, fiscal emergency means a projected deficit for the biennium, as most recently projected by the Oregon Department of Services, or at least 12% below the amounts estimated to be received for the biennium, as estimated under after the adjournment. Sine die of the odd-numbered year, single, you know, the whole nine yards. So the governor has the opportunity to declare this fiscal emergency and get these monies.
Senator Olson, may I, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please. That's why we're here.
You know, I'm feeling sensitive about the executive branch, legislative branch. If you're going to allow a exit road or ramp, why wouldn't you also let the legislature have an exit ramp? That they would have to take some definitive, strong action if they were going to go in there versus, I mean, you're allowing the governor, but why wouldn't you allow the legislature as well?
Honestly, sir?
Yeah.
We at times aren't prudent with the exercising of our use of these dollars. And we have swept $15 million of this, which keeps continually putting us behind the curve all the time. I'd just like to keep us ahead of the curve. And when we have swept these dollars, and for reasons I don't know, I wasn't here then, I don't know where the money went or why it went. Some of these monies were swept before the recession. So the question then would be, were they needed then? And it's not that I don't trust us, it's just the fact that it puts a layer of insulation between the people that want the money and someone to say, yes, we do need it.
Yeah. Chair.
Please.
Senator, I guess I'm struggling philosophically with the statement regardless of how you feel about what the legislature's done, if you're going to give the executive branch, which is not responsible for the governor, the budget, we make the budget as we make the laws. Now, the governor does have to sign off, etc. He has some veto power. I'm just speaking very philosophical in terms of the three branches of government. If there was something here where the legislature would have to take some definitive action to do this versus just the co-chairs of Ways and Means, I would, given what you've said about allowing the governor the power to do it, I think I'd be a little more comfortable. I'm speaking strictly as from a structural standpoint, the way we govern ourselves with the respect for the legislative branch. I'm just commenting on that line out of thinking. I hope you understand what I'm saying.
Chair, could I offer a clarification?
There is the requirement in the measure as it's written. The legislature would have to take statutory action during a fiscal emergency declared by the governor, so it's double layered.
Okay, I get that. But what worries me is we meet now every year. And the governor may choose to not take action or not see, etc. So we can't do anything. Basically, that's the only exception. So we might, it's like calling ourselves in a special session. Traditionally, the vast majority of the time, the governor calls us in. But we have the ability to call ourselves into a special session. So I'm just saying again, we don't need to discuss it further. I just find myself, I'm just questioning that or pondering that, Senator Olson, respectfully. I'm just being very respectful. I'm pondering that. That's all.
Madam Vice Chair, why don't we roll this over till next week and ask at least our half, because we cannot ask the other half because they don't necessarily respond to us. Ask Senator Devlin for comment.
Yes, I would love to have a comment from him, but I do want to put on the record that I revere the legislative process and our budget process, and I certainly put a lot of faith in the prudence of what our budget Ways and Means does, because it's made up of it's bipartisan. It is just representative of Oregon, and rather than putting this, I just don't want to take that power away from the Ways and Means. Let's just put it that way. Whether we hear from Ways and Means people or not. Thank you.
So we'll close the work session. The time for Senate Bill 432. Open a work session on 434.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 434 was previously heard on the 24th of February. It has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue, so it's returned with a revenue impact, a revenue light, and a minimum fiscal. This is, you recall, Senator Olson's measure to exempt from taxation up to $60,000 of the assessed value of home or personal property of veterans with 100% service-connected disabilities, extends the property tax exemptions. As you'll recall from the last discussion, there are three tiers, if this measure should pass, to the surviving spouses who remarry for the first time at the age of 57 or older.
And we do have a fiscal, correct?
A minimal fiscal and a revenue light. The revenue light actually gives a best guess of less than $5 million loss of property tax revenue, doing the best guesswork they can about the numbers of surviving spouses who would be eligible. And there's also a Dash 1 amendment that's at the dais and was posted. It was sort of a fallback for Senator Olson, depending on the outcome of the revenue impact, to sort of have a direction to go, depending on how the committee was inclined about the bill.
The Dash 1 amendment eliminates the spouse's ability to collect on that 100% disability.
That's correct. If they remarry, that's correct.
If they remarry.
Which is the current status of the law, sir.
And again, colleagues, this has a referral to
Finance and Revenue.
Finance and Revenue, and I would just point out, since I sit as the Vice Chair of Finance and Revenue, I think it will have a subsequent referral after that to the Joint Tax Committee on Tax Credit. So it's going to, it is a long haul no matter what we do. Any thoughts, colleagues, on the policy?
Remind me, how many veterans do we have in Oregon that are 100% disabled and are property owners of Scott, you said maybe 5,000?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, according to the testimony last time, the estimate was approximately 7,600 in Oregon that are 100% service-connected, and the best guess as to home ownership was maybe 60% of that, so you're in the neighborhood.
Which would be in the 4,200 range.
Any other thoughts, committee?
Yep. I wish I could have had some veterans here that are 100% disabled to get their views on this, or where else maybe they would have preferred to have assistance rather than property tax.
I think that's possible, Madam Vice Chair. I mean, we have the various groups that are out there. We can reach out to them and ask for additional input.
Yeah.
If you would please, counsel, we'll roll it over. And then if you're reaching out to the cast of characters that we know, American Vet, you know, Foreign Legion, VFW, American Legion, all those various groups, and see what comments. And then we'll move. Readdress this issue later. We have called close the work session on Senate Bill 434. You're open the final piece today. I think this is right. Am I right? Senate Bill, work session on Senate Bill 494. If you would please, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 494 was heard on February 24th. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. This is a measure that permits the Department of Transportation to renew or replace out-of-state service members' driver's licenses without a photograph.
And I've asked Ms. Joyce just to refresh our memory, because we did a lot of stuff in blur in the last couple of weeks because of various floor sessions. This, my understanding is this gives you the language to do something you think you're capable of already doing without too much problems.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Yes, Senate Bill 494 simply adds one more group of folks who can be granted a valid without photo driver license under existing law. It's very limited. And the bill from Senator Bates would add active duty military who are stationed out of state. So it would allow DMV to grant this kind of a license to folks in this situation.
Questions of Department of Transportation? Your pleasure, if you would, please.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 494 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Mona Sanderson moves Senate Bill 494 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the bill? Right. Any opposition to the bill? With that, the bill will move to the floor. Dr. Bates said last time around that he would volunteer to carry it on the floor. For next week, colleagues will get some more information on two of the bills we had up today, and then we'll move forward next week. We do have a stack of other bills that are coming to the committee in the this week. As you saw, some of them read across the floor. At the end of today's floor session, if you were still there, I think all four of us were. Some of those we're going to move to the front of the calendar just in case you know, because there are some issues that need to resolve. With that, the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is adjourned.